inside Syria. He doesn't represent the views of the Syrian inside Syria. At the end of the day, this promised military attack is going to affect first and foremost the Syrians inside Syria. And it will be the views of those people inside that I will be interested the most, not of Al-Jarba or anybody else outside the country. And when I'm representing my views, you know, that's all after talking to lots of people inside the country. I represent a political group that is mainly based inside Syria. Its leader is still lives in Damascus, and they are very strongly against the regime and against this strike. And we've been actually against the way the U.S. interfered politically with this conflict from day one. We thought there is a great opportunity in front of the U.S. here to play a very strong, brave political role. But what they demonstrated from day one is a failure to read the situation well. And you can judge that by the statement of Hillary Clinton. She kept repeating, Assad days are numbered, Assad days are numbered. And then it turned out that her days were numbered and the Assad state. I mean, isn't that also something that shakes the U.S. credibility, its political credibility and potential? I think yes. And the U.S.
continues to
be a very weak political player in this conflict, and I think it's time for it to change that.
I want to thank you very much for being with us. Reem Turkmeni is a member of the Syrian political opposition, Building the Syrian State Current. And I also want to thank our guest in Washington, Radwan Ziad, director of the Damascus Center for Human Rights Studies. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8:01. Coming up next is Voices from the Edge Talk Radio with host Joanne Hardesty. Get your progressive talk radio from a grassroots perspective.
Bring out your book.
Bring out your books.
KBOO is preparing for our legendary book and record sale.
We are accepting your donations of books, comics, LPs, CDs, DVDs, and VHS tapes. Your discards are another person's treasure, and all sales benefit. KBOO, bring your donations to the stations at 20 Southeast 8 between 9 a.m. and 7 p.m. weekdays.
Questions? Contact Ani by email at volunteer@kboo.org or by phone at 503-231-8032. Extension 213.
If you have a larger donation,
call to arrange a pickup. The last day to donate is Tuesday, September 24th. So don't wait. Bring in those CDs, LPs, books, and DVDs right away. Thank you.
The KBOO Board of Directors elections are underway. KBOO members can vote for up to 4 candidates. Ballots were mailed in mid-August. If you think you are a KBOO member and have not received a ballot, email Membership Director Andrew Geller at membership@kboo.org or call 503-231-8032, extension 207. Non-members can join KBOO and receive a ballot to vote. Just go to kboo.fm and click Donate on the top right-hand corner. The annual meeting is Sunday, September 15th from 1 to 4 p.m. at the Matt Dishman Community Center at 77 Northeast Knott Street in Portland. You can mail back your ballot or bring it to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. Ballots must be postmarked by September 10th or cast at the annual meeting by 2:40 p.m. to count. Get informed, get involved, and vote. Thanks.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
Good morning, good morning. I'm Joanne Hardesty, and welcome to Voices from the Edge. I've been away for a couple of weeks, and it's wonderful to be back and back in the mix. It is September, which means kids are back in school. It means that the political season has kicked off in Oregon. It means that we are still talking war once again, and we have a new candidate for war with Syria. And so today's program will be open. I want to know what's on your mind. How are you planning to move forward in this fall season and prepare for what will be probably one of the most nasty election seasons ever in 2014. You know, now that money is free speech it seems to start earlier and get more vicious quicker. So I want to start by doing a comparison between my participation in the 50th anniversary celebration of the March on Washington that took place here on August 24th and took place in D.C. on August 28th. I was so proud of Portland because it looked like we had about 2,500 people show up. It was the most beautiful experience to see people of all ages. There were a lot of young people, a lot of 20-somethings, a lot of seniors. There were people of all colors. There were people that were just in a very excited mood. And you know that life is good in Portland when you're marching and it's raining and people aren't complaining. Because it did drizzle on us a bit at the beginning of the march, but nobody lost their stride. It was just a wonderful, wonderful thing to see that people from all corners came out to participate. If I had one negative thing to say, I would just say that the program was way, way, way too long. And of course, I still question having politicians on the panel. It was, in fact, 50 years ago that the people decided that they wanted to conduct a march for jobs and for justice. And so it was kind of ironic to see politicians preparing themselves for the 2014 year by pretending somehow they had a civil rights record. But in spite of the politicians that showed up, it was a wonderful, wonderful day. There were a lot of heartfelt speeches. I think I cried twice that day. Once a young woman sung this song at the beginning of the march, and it just put me in tears. And I think half the audience was in tears. And then towards the end, there's this young man with the NAACP Portland who I am going to blank on his name, but it will come back to me. Or I could actually look at the program and tell you what his name is. But this particular young man surprised me to no end at how articulately wonderful he was that day. And he had everybody up on their feet. And that's a task when you have a lot of ministers who are participating in a program. We expect that from our ministers, but we certainly didn't expect that from that fabulous young man who participated in that program. And I will get you his name before this section of the program is over. If you were there, give us a call and tell me what you thought of Portland stepping up on a kind of rainy, drizzly Saturday morning. And then the sun came out bright and it was a beautiful day. Give us a call at 503-231-8187. And then, so Saturday, I was absolutely exhausted. It was a very, 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 very long day. And then Sunday, I got on the plane and went to D.C. And it was kind of funny because people kept saying, well, the march in D.C. was Saturday, so you're going to miss it. And I'm like, no, I'm actually going to the official march, which is on the 28th of August, and it's on a Wednesday, and it's going to be in D.C. And I know this because I've been following the website for the last 3 months, and people didn't believe me, but guess what? There were two marches in D.C. The march that took place on August 24th was organized by Al Sharpton. So that Al Sharpton could be the keynote speaker. And I understand it was a good march. There were a lot of people. They said tens of thousands of people showed up for that march. All the feedback I heard was it was absolutely wonderful. The other thing I got to do was to participate in a civil rights conference that took place on Tuesday in Washington, D.C., that brought together 10 people from the original march to share their remembrances of the original march and brought together young people who are currently, there was a huge delegation from Alabama State University. And I have to say, being in a room with young people who are in college, who are thinking about justice, who are thinking about the future, it just was totally inspirational for me. And I ended up being on a panel talking about the school to prison pipeline. Imagine that, being in D.C. and then people say to me, we think you have something to share. Would you be on this panel? And there I was. And that was fabulous. And so that led up to the march, of course, which took place on Wednesday, August 28th. And I have to say the march was absolutely heartwarming. I mean, it was... There were at least a couple of hundred thousands of people. There were at least 200,000 people that participated in the march. And the march was led by marchers from the original march. And so they became the marshals. They had sashes on. And it was kind of interesting trying to have a pace where, as you can imagine, if you marched 50 years ago, you probably weren't as... fast on your feet as you were 50 years ago, and yet you're surrounded by young people and all this energy, and people want to march like really fast. So they kept trying to slow us down, and then they would say, okay, start again. But having people who were at the original march marching with young people who are in college, and then being able to share the experience about what was happening 50 years ago was just invaluable. You do not get that kind of lesson in a college classroom. You can only get that lesson from people who have lived the experience. And so these people were absolutely open with what they felt, how they felt. I was surprised at how many people told their parents an untruth in order to be able to participate in the original march. Because as you can imagine, parents were very nervous about having their kids in harm's way. And so so people had all kind of stories. They told their parents they were going to go to the library or they were staying with a friend. I talked to one woman who ended up with a spread in Life magazine. And she came to D.C. with her Life magazine so that she could prove that 50 years ago, not only was she at the march, not only did she tell her mom that she was going to the library, but it was captured by Life magazine. And so she had to go home and tell her mom quickly what was going on, because she knew that that was going to be a national picture that a whole lot of people were going to see. But the woman was just so proud of her history, her experience, her opportunity to be there at the original march. And in fact, she talked about making her outfit and how she made her outfit in secret just to ensure that she would look really good when she participated in that march. So that's before them. So that was the day before. We had the opportunity to hear so many personal stories about people who, how participating in that march 50 years ago had fundamentally changed their life. So one by one, people talked about how they thought they got it before they went to the march, but being part of the community that went was just so phenomenal. And the thing that people today, somebody remarked on, was that 50 years ago, people put on their Sunday best. So, it wasn't the jeans and sweatshirts and tennis shoes that we see so much today at marches. But can you imagine putting on your Sunday shoes and your best clothing and then marching in the street? And that was exactly what people did 50 years ago. In fact, there were a couple of people that said they felt guilty that they, in fact, hadn't dressed up for the march because of their remembrance of the history of that activity. We march, and I have to say the march was absolutely fabulous. Once we got to the Lincoln Memorial where the program was going to take place, there must have been somewhere between 12 and 15 of those machines that you go through at the airport. And so think about 15 machines, 200,000 people, and everybody having to be totally searched before they went inside. So it took longer to get through security to get into Lincoln Memorial than it did to do the full march with three stops in Washington, D.C. And we're standing here in this line thinking, what is wrong with this picture? This is supposedly a people's march. And ironically, the program started at about 11:30 a.m., which meant that there were maybe 50 people inside the memorial, the Lincoln Memorial structure when the program started, because most of us were standing at the security line waiting to get in. I have a caller on the line, but if you want to join the conversation, give us a call at 503-231-8187. Hello, LJ. Welcome to KBOO.
Hey, Joanne.
Hey, LJ. How are you?
I am so good. Welcome home. I want you to know that Dave did a great job trying to fill your shoes, but I'll tell you, Dave is a sweet man, but he's no Joanne Bowman.
Well, Dave is so gracious to fill in anytime I need him. He steps in, and he's my guy. And
he is in reality your ex-partner on the show.
Yes, right? He is. He's my ex-partner. And, yeah, we want to get out Dave straight because, you know, I'm also married to a Dave, so we don't want to confuse people.
No, we don't want any confusion here. Okay, Joanne, let's put the meat on the table.
Let's put the meat on the table.
All right, so it's been 50 years.
Yes.
Since the March on Washington.
Yes, it has.
All right. But yet, Joanne, there's a concerted attack on Afro-Americans. We do have what they call the alleged new Jim Crow.
Yes.
According to some people, the old Jim Crow simply has never gone away. It's just taken on another form. Okay, so there's still no police accountability as far as violence against Afro-American people of color are concerned. We have that horrendous stop and frisk policy in New York, and according to Ray Kelly, and this is a statement that I read by the police chief of New York, Ray Kelly, he simply stated, and I'm quoting him, and I could be paraphrasing, but he did say he told our people of color to simply cooperate with this stop and frisk program. He said, because this is the reality of urban living.
How sad.
How sad. And it's incredible.
Well, and I have to say, it's also the same here, right? I mean,
yes,
so it's like,
it's, right. Of course it's the same here.
Yes.
Absolutely nothing has changed.
Right.
The police are not held accountable for what they do.
This is true.
The police can virtually get away with murder, Joanne.
Yes.
You know it.
Yes.
I know it, and they're essentially untouchable.
Yes.
All right. Now, can we also put on the table, if you think that that Trayvon is the new Emmett Till? Okay, I'll give somebody else a chance to talk to
that. No, I appreciate you calling. I appreciate you paying attention. And, you know, it's interesting because I am now asking the question, now what, right? We've had an opportunity to reflect on what the march was about 50 years ago. We have a chance now to say, well, let's see, 50 years ago, the top issues for African Americans were jobs, economic opportunity, police brutality, health care, and justice. Here we are 50 years later, the very top issues for African Americans are jobs, economic opportunity, police brutality, health care, and justice. And
Absolutely.
So when I listen to politicians pontificate about how far we've come, I have to question that because, yes, we don't have the signs anymore, but we've done a very effective job of letting African Americans know, especially young people, that they, in fact, have no rights that the police or politicians are woe to protect.
Joanne, can I just stop this minute?
Yes.
When an Afro-American dad has to sit down with his son,
yes,
and tell him how to behave.
Yes.
so he doesn't get gunned down.
Yes.
That's a sad statement on our society, Joanne.
And it also is the exact same thing that my 79-year-old dad's mom had to do when he grew up in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. How do you grow up to be an adult black man in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, 89 years ago? Mm-hmm. That is the exact same lessons that African-American parents are teaching their kids today.
Exactly the same thing. And Joanne, just one more thing, a little fact, all right? In the 18 to 35 demographic, one in three Afro-American men are in control of the prison industrial complex.
And yet we feel a need to have school police so that we can increase the capacity of sending kids directly from schools to prison.
Joanne, once you have a felony on your record,
yes,
you're out of the game.
Yes,
there's nobody going to hire you.
Right.
You are not going to get Section 8 housing. Right. And in some cases, you are not going to get food stamps.
Well, and actually, we have a move on in Congress now, which is the only thing you can get now with a felony conviction from the federal government is food support. But there is a move on in Congress to cut that out. How dare we feed people who've been to jail? Thank you for your call. It is wonderful to...
Thank you for opening up this topic.
You are...
Marches are great. They
yes.
feel good things.
Yes, they do.
To get people together. But people, both white folks as well as Afro-American folks, people of color, need to wake up and smell the coffee, Joanne, because this is not getting us anywhere.
No, and since...
It's dividing us.
Well,
yet again.
And it's purposeful.
Absolutely.
Thank you for your call. Have a great day.
Thank you, Joanne. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Right, bye-bye.
And so I was telling you about this fabulous young man from the NAACP. He's the first vice president. His name is Tony Funches. And Tony just had everybody on their feet in the park. I've known Tony for over a decade, but I had no idea that he was the caliber of public speaker that he is. But he was absolutely fabulous. And of course, I have to say Audrey Terrell, who's the president of the Portland NAACP, is pretty awesome in her own right. We have another caller on the line, and it is Joanne. Good morning, Joanne. Welcome to KBOO.
Yes, I'm glad you had good experiences with the 50th anniversary. And did you say your mother was 79?
My dad, 79.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm 78. But anyway, I have a need to tell you this, even though it's not important to your conversation. In March 1963, my ex-husband, my daughter and I came from California to go to Coos Bay to go on a cargo ship as migrants to Australia. My daughter was a year old on that cargo ship. And also, I thought when we were in Oregon in the terrible weather, I thought we were going to fall off the side of the mountain. But anyway, I know it's not important to your conversation. So I wasn't in the country for about 4 years after that. So anyway... thanks for the program, and I'm glad you had good experiences. Bye.
Bye. Thank you so much for the call, Joanne. And, you know, Joanne and I met each other recently. It was very cool. Here I am at Bipartisan, you know, doing my normal hangout, and that we recognized each other's voices and knew exactly who we were talking to. That's always a pleasure as one of your hosts here at KBOO to be out in the community and somebody go, I know you. You're on KBOO, aren't you? So that was very cool. Thank you very much for your call, Joanne. So I was just starting to talk about, and so we... Finally get through the security line. And then I find, and I'm thinking, great, because, you know, I'm early. I was at the front of the line. I'm thinking I'm going to be close enough to actually be able to see the president and all the other speakers. Imagine my surprise when I get inside finally and I realize that I'm at least going to be a football field away from the stage. And there are these large screen projectors up throughout the field. And it's blocked off, And there's only a certain area that we, the people, can be. So I realized that not only was I not going to be close to Oprah, I also wasn't going to be close to any of the speakers that were on the podium. And so if you were just a regular person and didn't have, I guess, whatever the price of admission was to be up where the president and first lady and Representative John Lewis and all those individuals were, you were basically watching TV. And so that's what we did. We marched and then we ended up watching TV sitting on the grass for an ungodly number of hours. Again, lots of politicians. And as I sat there among the people, I kept thinking, why am I sitting here listening to these politicians that I listen to all the time? And they always say the same stuff. And I realized it was because I was among these hundreds of thousands of people who believed that life could be different, better, that wanted to just stand up and be counted. So I was glad that I got to be one of those people that stood up to be counted that day. I have a caller on the line. Hello, Javi. Welcome to KBOO.
Thank you very much, Joanne. And I'd like to tell you why I think the Republicans want to cut the food stamp program out of the agricultural bill. And the reason is because it turns out that the war on drugs is winding down. And also, immigration is winding down, too. The Mexican government just invested $100 billion in its own rebuilding of its infrastructure with new port, airports, seaports, all sorts of things. And so I can see the immigration really slowing down. And it turns out I read an article once that one of the executives from Prisons for Profit said that if there's any change in the war on drugs or immigration policy, that they would lose their workforce.
Right.
So I'm thinking here that, you know, if people don't have food to eat, if they can't feed their families, they become desperate.
That's right.
They will turn to crime, and this will be a new resource for the prisons for profit. At the same time, you have to remember that in 2012, America exported $147 billion in agricultural and food products. That's up $2 billion from 2011. So at the same time, one in six people in America go to bed hungry. And it is it really, especially the vets, the children,
seniors,
and elderly. Now here's the latest thing that the latest thing that the Republicans want to cut the food stamps for. It turns out that that Walmart doesn't pay a living wage, and so many workers have to turn to food stamps to supplement their income. Well, here's the government putting a knife in the back of the American worker, saying not only are you struggling, but now we're going to take your food away while we export $147 billion in agricultural and food products. What is wrong with this picture? This is definitely a new resource for the prisons for profit.
Well, you're so right on so many levels, because as you know, the private prison contracts have a requirement of a minimum number of beds. And so if you fall under that minimum number of beds, the states who have those contracts have to pay for them anyway, as well as the federal government. And in fact, the highest numbers of new inmates are people who are immigrants, right? That's where the growth in the industry is coming right now.
Well, the prisons for profits, they don't want violent types.
No.
They want people like immigrants who are caught in the immigration net.
That's right.
Or marijuana users that are basically, you know, that are pretty much nonviolent.
Yes.
this is a terrible thing. It's, you know, you don't have to turn to an enemy, some guy with a beard in some Arabian country. You know, the enemy is right here. It's our own legislators who would take the food out of the mouths of children, and especially out of veterans. You know, they gave their life to fight for America, and a lot of them are hungry.
And homeless.
Yeah,
right.
It's a terrible thing, and at the same time, we're, you know, people are still struggling over the whole jobs issue, but they're not aware of the next wave. And the next wave that's going to really decimate the job program is robots, 3D printers, and artificial intelligence. Mm-hmm. And so I think we have to, instead of like always being behind the behind, you know, like running, trying to catch up from behind. We got to look ahead,
yes.
And we got to work on programs that make it easy for people as these new machines come online.
Right.
That will replace so many jobs. So forget the outsourcing of jobs and the outsourcing of factories. Look forward to protecting yourself or making sure. I would call for a guarantee. I don't like the term, but a sort of standard of living income that we all get because these machines will do the work. Each one will do the work of 20 people. It's,
right.
I mean, I don't know.
Let me just say that, especially here in Oregon, where we keep patting ourselves on the back about our sustainability and, you know, all the natural resources we have. What I don't hear is our elected political leadership having a vision for the future of economic opportunities for Oregonians, right? What are we doing here? What is the next innovation that we're creating that's actually going to have us be able to provide a significant number of living wage jobs, and so that we are creating those industries, those opportunities here? I mean, right now we talk about the creative class, quote unquote, which is 0.0001% of the population, right? Let's talk about how do we take kids with a high school diploma and give them an opportunity to create a sustainable industry here in our local community. I don't hear anybody talking about that. We keep talking about these elusive high-tech jobs that are going to mysteriously appear if we give away enough tax breaks. So we've got the wrong kind of political leadership to have a visionary future. And so hopefully people start thinking about that when 2014 arrives, that what we need is the political leadership that has a vision of where we're going, not a vision of how do we just keep sticking our fingers in the dike to try to keep the waters at bay. Thank you so much for your call.
Thank you. I appreciate
your thoughtfulness, and you have a fabulous day.
You too.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye. 503-231-8187 is the number you can call if you'd like to join the conversation. Jawasi. Oh, what a cool name. Good morning. Welcome to Cable.
Hey, thank you for the compliment.
You're welcome.
I'd just like to pay a compliment in return. I really appreciate everything that KBOO does for the community and the cause of the information age, because that's where we're at. So I just wanted to talk a little bit about food stamps, because, you know, right now we've switched over to this card, and so in the time before it was food stamps, and if we go a little bit further back, not that far, it's actually they're ration cards.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, we just couldn't afford to eat.
Right.
And so with the ration card, it allowed the average person to eat even while all of the money in the even while all the money in the country went to corporations like IB Farben, who were blowing people up for profit.
Right.
So currently that's what we're doing, is we have these corporations like Raytheon or Honeywell who are making these cruise missiles.
Right.
And we're exploding huge numbers of profits, or killing people for profit. And as a result of it, we can't afford to eat.
Right. And for profit for a very, very select few group. Right. So it's like we're going to just keep blowing people up and killing people and starting wars all over the world. And we're killing people of color all over the world for the sake of a few corporations getting filthy rich.
Right. Well, I just want to recast the conversation of food stamps and the reality of ration cards. Because the way that a ration card works is that it not only supports the person who's eating, which is of interest to any state or county,
right,
or nation, but it also serves to revitalize business at the,
yes,
failing stores.
That's true,
because all these local companies, they get supported by the ration cards coming in. You can see all over town,
right,
the stores are, you know, failing. There's, right, empty real estate. But you also see these little grocery stores and you know, mom-and-pop gas stations saying, we accept EBT.
Right.
Please bring us your ration cards, because we need government money too.
Right, right.
So anyway, I appreciate what you guys are doing.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate the call. You have a great day.
Thank you.
503-231-8187 is the number to call. Hello, Jeff. Welcome to Cable.
Hi, thank you. How are you?
I'm good. How about you?
I'm great.
Good.
I'm blessed to be an American, but, you know, as an American, I have a lot of worries.
Yes.
I mean, I've been listening to what you were talking about with the African Americans,
mm-hmm.
and just how desperate our situation seems, and what is my responsibility as an American? What can I do? What organizations that I don't know about that I can make differences?
Oh, my gosh. There are, like, so many organizations out there. The question is, where's your passion, right? Because the reality is that organizational work is hard, right? Bringing people together, organizing people to take collective action, it's really hard work. So I always go at it from what's my passion. So right now, the new organization I'm working with is called the Campaign to End the New Jim Crow, which was started because of us all reading a book by Michelle Alexander called Mass Incarceration and the Time of Colorblindness.
Uh-huh.
And so that book sparked us to say, after we read it, we got to do something. And so we held a couple of community forums, 150 people showed up at each one. We talked about the book. We were able to bring Michelle Alexander to town. 1,200 people showed up, and that was very cool. And then out of that, we formed this organization that we just meet every couple of weeks at PCC Cascade. Twice a month, so every other week. We meet on a Saturday morning from 11 to 1, and we just talk about how we can address the issues within our sphere, which is, you know, all about mass incarceration, the school-to-prison pipeline, and racial profiling, right? So those are the things. That's how I got into that organization. But what feeds your passion? I know a wonderful organization that's dealing with school pushout, the Portland Parents Union. They do a fabulous job of working with community to end putting demands on the school system to say, wait a minute, kids don't learn if they're kicked out, they're suspended or expelled. And why do we expel three times as many African-American and Latino kids as we do white kids?
Right.
And so we got to fix that. So it just depends on what feeds your passion, because this is, I'm finding out, lifetime work. So so you got to be fed by something other than people telling you how great and wonderful you are.
Right. The comment you made earlier about the politicians say that they've made such a compliment, and here 50 years later, we're still dealing with the same stuff.
Yes.
You know, it's like my passion is new politicians, or how do we get people in there that are actually going to do something?
Yes.
And just getting a paycheck. I mean,
well, you know, that is the right question to be asking right now, because quite frankly, right now we should be looking for community members that represent community members to file
right.
for every seat that we possibly can, right? And my husband and I have this debate all the time. Our bench is not deep. And our bench is not deep because we don't do the work as a community to identify people with the potential to be good political leaders. And in fact, one of the things that makes me crazy here is how we recycle old politicians over and over and over again. It's like they weren't that good the first time they were in office, but yet we will reelect them again because we know the name.
Right.
I mean, I'm appalled by that, because I think you can't live in a state with 2.5 million people and you can't find new people to run for office.
Right.
Something's wrong with that.
It's laziness.
Yes, it is laziness, and it's arrogance, right? It's arrogance of having political parties deciding they know what's best, who should lead us. And they pick that based on their allegiance to one party or the other, right? Not based on what have they done. And I talk about politicians like with one brush. We've got a couple of really excellent ones, like Senator Jeff Merkley. I love Senator Jeff Merkley, but I love Senator Jeff Merkley when he was the executive director of the World Affairs Council, because he's the same man today that he was when he was the executive director of the World Affairs Council. He's
nice.
Principled. He's principled. He's honorable. And he will tell you whether he can do what it is you want him to do. No BS with him. I can't say that about too many other politicians in this state.
Yeah. That's for sure.
And so I would encourage you. I mean, there are a lot of people. I mean, I live out towards Gresham, so I know Occupy Gresham is still operating, and they certainly are looking for people that want to run for public office.
Well, I was, you know, raised in Portland, and my wife and I live over in Eastern Oregon now, so quite a ways away, but we do have the internet, and we listen to you every day, and it's like we just want to get more involved where we could have some direction with what we can do.
You know,
problems are at hand that we can't change, but there's things we can do. So.
Yes, there are things you can do, and quite frankly, you would be amazed at how many people in Eastern Oregon are feeling just like you are. Right, I call myself. I live in an area that I call the non-represented area of Portland, because it's so close to Gresham that Portland could care less, and Gresham could care less because I'm not in Gresham. Right, so if I just move my house two doors down, I'd be in Gresham. But so I'm in an area that really has no political representation because, you know, it's on the edge. And so I know exactly how you feel in Eastern Oregon because the politicians could care less because they're like, well, you're not even really in my district.
Exactly. Exactly. A lot of things get changed over here by votes over there. And it's just, I just don't know what I can do or where I would even look on the internet to try to find something that I could put my passion towards.
I know that there's a statewide organization. There's a couple of them. There's Rural Organizing Project, which has been around for a bazillion years. That's actually done a great job of connecting progressives in rural communities. And if you go online to Rural Organizing Project, I bet they've got projects going on right now in your local community. There's another organization called Oregon Action, which is a statewide organization that trains low-income people to advocate for their own best interests.
Yeah.
That you can find them online. Now, they have an office in Portland and one in Medford, but I know the one in Medford actually does work in Eastern Oregon. And so Rich Rohde has been there for a bazillion years, and he's fabulous. And so, you know, and I just got a note from my fabulous engineer that says, if you're not living on the edge, you're taking up too much space. And
really?
I absolutely agree with that. You know, people get a little annoyed with me because they say I'm just too in your face. But I'm getting old, and I just don't have the patience that I used to have. I used to believe people when they told me that they were trying to do good things for the community. Now I check their record, and they either have or they haven't, right? And so I don't have a lot of patience for those who say they do good things but don't actually really do good things.
Right. Me neither.
You have a great day.
You too. Thank you so much for what you're doing. Keep doing it, and we'll keep listening.
All right. Thank you so much. I'm so glad to know that Eastern Oregon's in the house. Let me let you know what's coming up today on The Boo. At 9, Teresa Mitchell hosts Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know. At 9:30 on Fight the Empire, the topic is peak oil. At 10, hear Eric Cascadia headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15 on Flashpoint, we hear from organizers united against military action in Syria and from an Egyptian journalist reporting on the continued human rights crisis in Egypt. At 11 on Between the Covers, the guest is Oregon author and creative writing teacher Stevan Allred, whose new book is a simplified map of the real world. At 11:30 on Black Book Talk, the guest is Denorja Taylor, whose latest work, If by Chance, deals with a generational curse in a small Pacific Northwest community. Thank you, KBOO listeners, for your generous support. If you haven't become a member, just go online, go to kboo.fm, click the tip jar, and become a member that way. We've got callers all lined up, so back to the phone line. Hello, Sherelle. Welcome to KBOO.
Hello. I was out for the Martin Luther King event downtown. And
wonderful.
I didn't make the march, but it was a beautiful day. Like you say, it was wonderful amongst many, many great people. It was a great thing. And I just wanted to say real quickly that perhaps, well, I listened to Democracy Now!, of course, and the Grayson was on there, and I think he was a little bit way over optimistic about this new war effort being defeated in Congress. I don't trust that. I have a feeling, of course, that it's going to go through. So I'm suggesting and talking with other people about a national No War Friday sick out, everybody sick out tomorrow, and those who cannot afford to or it's too much jeopardy for their jobs wear gray armbands, and then a continuance of that is a boycott on shopping. Yeah, buy food, get gas, but don't shop.
Mm-hmm.
And that way the corporations will see and the politicians will see that we exist out here because we're going to war for corporate interests, and people will die for corporate interests, and our politicians ignore us and don't see us. So if we just kind of disappear with our money and we slow down the country at least considerably, I don't know. That's all I can think of, and I don't want to take up time on your wonderful show. And
well, thank you so much. My wonderful show is here because of wonderful people like you.
Well, so, that's right. I am a member, and yes. I was happy to come in with my money and say I want this for KBOO Talk Radio particularly.
Well, so. Wonderful. Thank you so much for your support. We appreciate it and your thoughtful suggestion. See what some other callers have to say about that. Thank you.
All righty.
Have
Bye-bye.
A great day. And thanks for participating in the march. Who else do we have?
Marie from Hood River, and I have just 2 points, and I'm going to try to keep it under 2 minutes.
Okay.
Okay, and by the way, Joanne, you rock. You're the best.
Oh, thank
so my
you.
You're welcome. So my 2 points are, like Ralph Nader said, follow the money. And I think yes. one thing that we as Oregonians and a few South Washingtons could help us, Southern Washingtons, is think about our money. How much of our money is going to federal programs we don't want? What's happening with Oregon? What about our fires? And I think that because you have experienced legislature, if there is a way that we could have more of our money helping our issues instead of it all going off to federal, then it turns into bombs and bullets.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know the technicality of all to do that legislative-wise, Joanne, but I know that's your background in legislature.
Right.
And then I have one more point, and I'm done. And then I want to hear what you have to say.
Okay.
You have such a great background in depth in politics. So my second idea, and actually the colleges before me had a great segue to that about shopping, and I have mentioned this on a table before, and I believe that we could stop wars by having a non-commercial Christmas. If many people would say,
yes.
we are not buying sugar for Christmas.
Yes.
Stop the sugar consumption. Stop the cheap plastic stuff. We would literally change the whole economy with Christmas. It might sound simplistic, but I believe it's more fundamental than people believe. I hope to hear what you say, and I'll get off and then listening carefully to your reply, Joanne.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate your call and appreciate you being a loyal listener. And so, in regard to sending less money to the federal government, I don't think that we could change the percentage with state legislative action, but I wouldn't write it off. I would get in touch with my local legislator and say, you should propose a legislation that says we're going to disconnect from the federal tax structure. I think that there have been some right-wing efforts to do that, but there hasn't been any that's been very thoughtful and thinking about it from a progressive perspective. So I think that that would be a great thing to have legislators look at. So I would contact my legislator and have them ask the legislative council to start looking at that process. And so I'm going to go back to the phone line because I got Hello, Elliot. Welcome to KBOO.
Yes. I'd like to make a kind of structural or strategic point about the left in the United States. Occupy Wall Street / Occupy Portland, unlike the Tea Party, which was, you know, secretly funded by right-wing billionaires, didn't elect a single person to Congress. They largely dissolved.
Good point.
Mm-hmm. And you know, it's not well known that after World War II, there was an organization called ADA, Americans for Democratic Action, that largely brought together a tremendous number of liberals and progressives that provided a lot of the intellectual and social firepower to passed the reforms of the civil rights era and the Great Society. But today, an amazingly large percentage of the time on cable and other stations like it is taken up with having individual, very gifted authors who are essentially trying to make a living selling their books. People like Ralph Nader, Chris Hedges, mm-hmm. Bartlett and Steele, and the list, Michael Moore, the list goes on. And nobody ever notices that they have extremely large egos. And one such person gave a talk at the Unitarian Church recently. He has had at least 3 bestsellers in the past about the inequities in the tax and the lobbying system. And I asked him, why he isn't more of an activist, and he says, I'm more of an investigative reporter.
Mm-hmm.
And the bottom line is that if all of the sources, all of the rather narcissistic, high ego authors who came on KABU were part of one large organization that tried to work out some sort of common agenda,
right,
and to mobilize a large numbers of people in the streets, that there might be more, of an Occupy caucus in the state and federal legislatures.
Why do you think that's so?
That's my comment.
Why do you think that's so hard for the left to do?
Well, you have practical experience. I've listened enough to KABU that, you've had some legislative experience, and you've had a lot of experience in organizing.
Mm-hmm.
And, I'd include in that group, one of the best books in recent years in the African-American community is Michelle Alexander's, book on mass incarceration.
That's right.
And sort of, quasi re-enslavement, she's not a part of any sort of superordinate organization either that's trying to essentially compensate for and compete with organizations on the right,
she is, and
Americans for Prosperity.
I disagree with you. I think Michelle Alexander has really become that kind of national organizer. When I think about all the new Jim Crow groups that have formed around the country and how she works to support those groups and they're organizing on the ground, I think you're wrong about that.
I don't disagree that she's mm-hmm. active. I'm saying that that she's not part of a kind of focused super coalition along with people,
but I don't think that's her fault. I don't think that's her fault. I think that it is the left that has traditionally cared less about people who've been incarcerated because they were primarily black and brown. And so it didn't impact the progressive left's economic opportunities to be concerned about that. So I think it's not... I think it's just a lack of care by the left. The left didn't care about people being incarcerated. And quite frankly, the left works hard to give those union jobs for people who are incarcerated to expand those. And so as a former legislator, I saw that in action myself. They want more people in jail, not less, because that means more jobs. So it's complicated. It's complicated. It's not, I don't think it's all one way or the other, but I do think the left has gone out of their way to be ignorant about mass incarceration in this country. But thank you.
We've got to work on that.
Yes, we do. Thank you so much for your call. I appreciate it. We've got a couple of more callers that we're going to get in. And hello, Sheila. Welcome to KABU.
Thank you. I have to respond to the woman who called earlier who said we should not shop for a day.
Right, right.
Well, I think not shopping is great, but one day, I think that's very naive, because if you need something, you're going to go out the next day, and all the businesses and the manufacturers and the big corporations, they know that if you need something, you're going to get it. If you sit out and you don't buy anything today, tomorrow or next week, you're going to go out and spend your money, and they're going to benefit anyway. So I think it's really naive to say, don't shop for a day.
Well, and especially if your goal is to impact national corporations, right? Or I should say international corporations, because if you're going to hurt the small mom and pop stores with one day of non-shopping. But I do think it's a creative idea to think about how do you impact the economic bottom line.
Well, you know, the other thing, and this goes along with the same thing, was the Occupy movement.
Mm.
What did they do? They went and sat in parks, and they didn't do anything really impactful. In England, they brought down one of the phone companies. Mm. They made them change their policies because what they did was they went in front of the businesses and prevented the people from going in and shopping.
Right.
But
well,
if you stand outside a corporate office, they're going to look down out of their ivory towers, and they're going to laugh.
So you're the second person.
Standing there. You're not impacting sales. What they want... what they're concerned about is how are you going to affect my bottom line? You don't affect the bottom line by standing outside or milling around in a park.
So you are the second person today that asked what Occupy, what did they accomplish? One of the things I saw firsthand is that they fed 3,000 people three times a day hot meals. And so, and that was downtown Portland. And when Occupy disappeared, I had to ask myself, 3,000 homeless people didn't just disappear off the street in downtown Portland. They
right.
just now are invisible. But the fact that a group of volunteers came together and three times a day had donated food that they could give hot meals to 3,000 people. Previous caller said, well, they didn't take over any offices. That was not their intent. Their intent was not to emulate the political structure that was in place. Their attempt was to say, what are the needs of the people right here, right now? And how do we let people know that we've got people in need in this community? So I disagree that they didn't serve a purpose. What I hope is that they are reforming and thinking about taking some political action as campaign season starts heating up.
Well, let them start feeding people more than just the brief time that they were organized.
Well, but it's not.
People still need to eat.
It wasn't
they're gone.
But it wasn't.
Occupy's gone.
But wait a minute. It wasn't their job. Whose job is it to feed hungry people in our community? It wasn't the volunteers, the kids out of college, and the seniors.
I don't deny that.
Right.
I don't deny that. But you're saying that's what they accomplished. And I'm saying it was too short a time. People are still starving.
Yes.
We still have people that are making billions while they cut food stamps.
But we are targeting the wrong people. The people that are responsible for that sit on the city council, on the county commission, in the state governor's mansion. Those are the people that are responsible for those homeless people being hungry on the street. They're
right.
The ones that we need to put pressure on to take action, not the occupiers. I mean, they saw a need and they filled it. And then what happened? The downtown business interests didn't look pretty enough for them to make money downtown, so they got the police to move them out. But it didn't change the fact that there were 3,000 people that were hungry, living on the street, and pretty downtown Portland. Thank you very much.
I agree with you on that point.
Okay. Well, thank you. I appreciate you calling. I appreciate you letting me challenge you. This has been a wonderful interaction. Thank you for the call.
You're welcome.
Have a great day. I'm going to try to squeeze one more in before I have to call it a day. Okay, Vernon, you're going to get the last word if you can do it in 30 seconds or less.
Joanne, I love your passion.
Oh, thank you.
Aim higher. The problem is corporate. It's not petty government officials. It's the big corporations. And if Congress votes to attack Syria, we got to stop working, stop shopping, stop buying gas, stop paying bills, absolutely shut it down. Take your shoes off, go out in the garden, take a deep breath, and realize what your real needs are. Air is free. Water is still available. People in jail are going for a month without eating. We can make it. We can pull together as a community and build a new system that works.
I am so
going to be changing every element of our lives.
I am glad you are the last word today. We're out of here. I'm Joanne Hardesty. See you next week, same time, same place, same station. Have a fabulous day.
Stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your rights.
good morning. Thank you for listening to KBOO. It's KBOO Portland, just a minute now before 9 o'clock. Coming up in 1 hour, it is Air Cascadia with headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. Actually, before that, at 9:30 on Fight the Empire, host Per Fogering interviews insurance actuary and writer Gail Tverberg on the growing gap between the price that oil exporters require to keep drilling and the price that importers can afford to pay. At 10, it's Air Cascadia. 10:15, you'll hear Flashpoints with guest host Kevin Pina speaking with organizers uniting against military action in Syria, including Medea Benjamin of Code Pink. And Kevin examines the continuing human rights crisis in Egypt. At 11 this morning on Between the Covers, host Leanne Krantz welcomes Oregon author and creative writing teacher Stephen Allred to discuss his debut linked short story collection, A Simplified Map of the Real World. And at 11:30 on Black Book Talk, host Patricia Welch, O.B. Hill, and Emma Jackson Ford speak with Denorja Taylor, who writes science fiction for all ages and all kinds of people. That is all coming up this morning, but stay tuned. Up next, it's Teresa Mitchell hosting Press Watch with news you're not supposed to know. Coming up next on KBOO.
Wednesdays in Portland are a little more festive these days, thanks to creative collaborations and Hump Day PDX. Hump Day PDX is a street festival in Southeast Portland, featuring the live music and art exhibits of creative entrepreneurs who are living on the streets. There are also family activities to enjoy, food to eat, and a beer garden for drink, all organized by creative collaborations in support of struggling artists and in an effort to stimulate the local neighborhood economy. The next Hump Day PDX is September 11th from 7 to 10 p.m. at Southeast 9th and Belmont in Portland. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm.